Well, thank you. I'm honored to be part of such an esteemed panel today. My talk is going to speak generally about how you might go about doing a return on investment type of analysis in this kind of setting, and then I'll use one specific analysis that we've done of the ASSIST program that Eunice described to illustrate. No financial relationships to disclose. So what is return on investment? So technically, return on investment is the difference between the net benefits of some program and the costs divided by the costs. So for example, if we estimate the net benefits of some program to be $1,100, the cost, the amount that we invested in that program was $100, then we would estimate the return on investment in this case to be 10. That is, for each dollar that we invest, we return $10 to the investor. It's a fairly common technique in sort of traditional accounting. So if I'm trying to decide whether to build a factory to make more cars or evaluating a factory that I built, it's pretty straightforward for me to estimate a return on investment because all of the inputs, all of the outputs have a market value. All of the costs of construction, the labor, the cars that I'm selling, everything has a market value. So it's easy to assign a dollar value. And so it's used often in that setting. It's becoming more popular in policy analysis as one of the tools that governments can use to measure the value they create through programs. In this case, what we're going to do is estimate the amount of value returned to the state of California for each dollar invested in these prevention and early intervention programs. When you combine this with other analyses, some of which Eunice has described, then you get a pretty good idea of the impact of your programs. So there are a number of challenges to estimating return on investment in this setting. Most of the outcomes have no market value at all. The things that we think of as being the most important things, like willingness to intervene, for example, lower suicide attempts, have no market value to them at all. And so that causes a challenge because this is, after all, a financial calculation. You have to think about whose benefits and costs you're considering. So the level of aggregation is important. Are you talking about the people for whom the intervention was designed? Are you talking about the state as a whole? Are you talking about the state government? So that's one challenge. Many of these policy initiatives, especially these types of interventions that are early interventions, have an impact over a very long period of time. And so it's difficult to assess the impact because we haven't observed the full impact yet. And so we have to guess about what the impact is going to be over a very long period into the future, and that's always challenging. And so it's important to distinguish short-term and long-term outcomes and to try and assign value to both of those to the extent that you can. Unfortunately, in many cases, there's a lack of adequate data. So many of these interventions that we're talking about are fairly innovative, and so we don't have a lot of data to tell us what the impact is on things that we're going to need for a return on investment. We might know how effective they are in general, for example, in improving willingness to intervene, but we don't know necessarily what their impact is on something that has a financial component. So how are we going to do this for CalMesa? So step one is first to develop a conceptual model that links the intervention itself to short-term outcomes and long-term outcomes. And we've done that. I'll show you an example of that. Step two, then, is to identify sources of data to plug in values to that model. So you estimate some short-term outcome, you think of some short-term outcomes that should be affected by this intervention, and you need some sort of estimate of how those short-term outcomes will change, and so you need to identify sources for that, and you also need to identify sources of data for the financial value or the particular costs and benefits of this program. Step three, then, would be to actually estimate the return on investment once you have all of your data. And step four, which is critical, particularly in this setting, is to perform sensitivity analyses to test the feasible range of values. As I've described already, we're going to be making guesses as to what's actually going to happen over time. Because we don't actually have data to tell us what did happen, it's important to test the assumptions that go into our model. And so this step four is a critical part of the return on investment analysis in this setting. Okay, so the example I'm going to describe specifically is ASSIST, which Eunice described. So this is the gatekeeper intervention. This is our conceptual model. So first, CalMesa hired LivingWorks to train assist trainers. The short-term outcome of that training is the number of trainers that they've trained who will then go out into the community. Longer-term outcomes then are the number of gatekeepers that they train over the course of their career as a trainer. And finally, I've combined a bunch of long-term outcomes in this last point. But ultimately, the goal is to prevent suicide attempts. And so that is a long-term outcome. And then in addition, because this is a return on investment calculation, we look at the effect on medical costs associated with suicide attempts, and then the impact on lifetime wages for prevented suicide deaths. So we have very good data from from LivingWorks on how much was spent and how many people they had trained. They have been doing this for a while, and they also had good data on average what happens once they've trained someone. So on average, the LivingWorks trained trainers are active for up to 14 years. On average, they train 150 gatekeepers in the community over those 14 years. And those we know are also active. The gatekeepers then are active on average for 10. So we have pretty good data for estimating this piece of our model because LivingWorks has collected data over time on their program. We don't have very good data on what is the impact of assist training on suicide prevention. So there have been studies of assists that have looked at willingness to intervene, for example, and it's been shown to be effective. But very few studies have actually looked at the impact on suicide attempts. We found three studies of gatekeeper-type interventions. One of those studies was an assist study in schools. The U.S. Air Force had a very large suicide prevention intervention that included gatekeeper programs, and so there were some results from that. And then also this other type of gatekeeper program called SOS, which was also implemented in schools. We wound up going with the estimates from the SOS study. The study design was stronger. They had a good comparison group, so we felt better about the estimates that we got of the actual impact. And furthermore, in this case, unlike the Air Force study, we could translate the way it was designed, we could actually translate the results into a per gatekeeper effect, which we needed. And so based on that study, we estimate a 34.8% reduction in suicide attempts, which translates into 0.03 averted suicide attempts per gatekeeper per year. So going back, combining that with our data from before, we estimate that over 10 years, each gatekeeper will prevent 0.3 suicides, for suicide attempts rather. That translates into about 3,600 serious suicide attempts averted over the 24 years that the gatekeepers who've been trained as part of this first investment will be active, we think. Using data from the World Health Organization and other sources, we broke that into the number of deaths. It's about one death per suicide attempt, incapacitations, and minor injuries. Using data from a study of California spending on suicide attempts, we have estimates of the amount of medical spending for each type of suicide attempt. So this is spending on emergency response, emergency department visits, and in some cases, particularly for incapacitation, hospitalizations that can last a while. So this is the average spending in California on each of these types of suicide attempts. Lifetime earnings is a key economic outcome in this case. Suicide attempts that would end in death, that have been prevented, allow someone to continue to work. Again, this is an economic analysis, so there are many other things that people do. Some of them may not actually work, but because we're focused on economics, we focus on lifetime earnings. So we use data from a variety of sources focused on the California population. So we pulled as much of this for California as we could get, and we convert all of it to 2015 dollars. So here's our process. First, we translate the attempts to deaths, and As I mentioned before, about 1 in 25 suicide attempts result in death. We then assigned estimated suicide deaths into an age and gender category based on California data. So this distribution comes from California suicide deaths. So this represents, if we had 100 suicide deaths, we'd split them into these age categories and gender categories this way. We also know average lifetime or average annual wages for each one of those age and gender categories. So that's where they start. So we prevented a suicide death. It's a male, 37. So they start off with annual wages of $51,407. And then we're going to grow those wages until the age of 65, and that's going to be our estimate of lifetime wages for that person. In the course of growing those wages, we account for unemployment. We account for death from other reasons. And we also account for the time value of money and get a final estimate per person, per averted suicide death, of lifetime earnings. So then we plug those into our model where we can estimate a return on investment. We know how much was spent per year on ASSIST, $356,000. We have an estimate of how many suicide deaths will be prevented as a result of that annual investment. we calculate the present value of work income at $386 million. So there were 145 deaths, if you'll recall, and that translates into lifetime earnings of $386 million. The present value of the medical costs associated with all suicide attempts was about $8.6 million. And if you combine those and plug it into our equation, we get a return on investment of about 11.07. So for each dollar invested per year by CalMESA in this ASSIST program, we estimate the return over the next 28 years to California of just over $1,000. Okay. So this is the critical stage too, the sensitivity analysis. As you've seen, there are a lot of assumptions that go into this model. It is economics, after all. And so we have to test each one of those assumptions. We have fairly good data to estimate the effect of gatekeeper programs, but it wasn't ASSIST, and it wasn't applied to the California population. It was high school students, and it was a different gatekeeper program. So we think it's a reasonable estimate, but probably isn't actually what the effect of this will be in California. So the exercise that we performed was, well, what would the break-even point? So we get this very high return on investment of $1,100. If we calculate the effectiveness at the break-even point would be the point at which for each dollar you invest, you get $1 back. So you're just breaking even. If we start there and back up, keeping everything else constant, back up to our effectiveness estimate, which we, in our analysis I've showed you, is three gatekeepers prevent one suicide attempt. The break-even point is the point at which it would take 160 gatekeepers to prevent one suicide attempt. So much lower effectiveness. So instead of one suicide attempt prevented per three gatekeepers, we're now saying even if it's as low as it takes 160 gatekeepers to prevent one suicide attempt, the state would still break even. So that makes us fairly confident that even though we probably haven't got the actual estimate, it would have to be much lower effectiveness, and we would still have a positive return for the state of California. The other model assumptions that we tested are to include other costs of training. So the costs that we looked at here are the amount that CalMESA actually spent for LivingWorks, but you can imagine going forward that you might want to account for rental space to perform the training, some sort of compensation for people who are going through the training, either in payment or opportunity cost. Lower lifetime earnings for people who attempt suicide. There's a high correlation, or a higher correlation, rather, between suicide attempts and mental health disorders. That population probably doesn't earn at the average rate that we use. We use the average wages for California, so it might be a little bit lower for that population. So we consider that as well. This is sort of the dismal science part of economics. A life saved is a life that then goes on to have medical care. So there might be additional spending on medical costs for survivors, and so we considered some of that as well. All of these we tested, and so we still feel confident in our estimate, at least that Cal Mesa is getting a positive, the investment for Cal Mesa is a positive return for the state of California. Now, I should say at this point, the number that UNIS reported was our estimate for the state government. So that was another level I wasn't going to cover. But briefly, we looked at just what the return for the state government would be. And UNIS described this. This was in terms of tax income. So if you take the lifetime earnings and compute the tax, the income tax in California, part of that, that's the lifetime earnings part for the state government. And then also the state government pays for some of the cost of suicide attempts through Medi-Cal, which is their Medicaid program. And so when you include those pieces, the return for the state of California is about $50 for each dollar invested. The government, sorry, of California. Okay. So some conclusions. So I've described some of the limitations along the way. One thing I want to focus on, though, in this is the second point. So we've only focused on economic outcomes. And as I mentioned earlier, these are probably the least valuable outcomes, in some sense, of these programs. And so we have almost certainly underestimated the total value of some of these interventions. But it's very difficult to find economic value estimates for some of these things. And maybe you wouldn't want to find economic value for some of these things. So we're unable to estimate the full impact. The report, the analysis I've described today, is already available as a RAND report that you can access through RAND.org. And we are also analyzing two other interventions, one from each of the other main focuses, Cal Mesa, student mental health, and marketing campaign to reduce stigma. The student mental health report is almost out, so look for that if you want to see more of this. So, and I should acknowledge my co-authors, reviewers in Cal Mesa, for this. And I'm happy to answer questions or talk if you have other questions, but if that's not feasible, you can email me at ashwood@rand.org. So, thank you.
It's really been fantastic watching the Cal Mesa work evolve over the past few years and now having this rigorous evaluation, so congratulations. So we have a few minutes for questions, and I'm going to open it up. I have several questions, but I'll defer to the audience first before I plunge in. Yes, ma'am. Can you actually stand up? It's hard to hear. Do you mind?
Gentlemen over there. I was kind of wondering, Dr. Mendersohn, you talked about now another thing now we know is likely a consequence of trauma tends to occur early. But I sort of struck the way you talked about prevention and early intervention. So we're still a little late in the game, talking about some people are getting in trouble in high school. Would you care to comment on this and talk about other directions we might think through the earlier intervention?
So the classic work in this area is the ACEs study. You all know the ACEs study? Done by Vincent Flay, which basically shows that starting at a very early age, down when a person is 1, 2, and 3, they're exposed to adverse events, and that those adverse events then become very predictive of that person having a behavioral health disorder by the time they're 18. And there's very good data to support predictive models for various ages, and there is an adverse event scale that can be used to actually do that. So we actually have the tools to do that. We are trying to adapt those kinds of tools into the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So example, we were successful in adapting a depression screen. We were successful in adapting ESPERT. Now we got to work on children and get things adapted for children, so we picked this stuff up much earlier. You're absolutely correct, basically.
I'm so interested about the comment about no market value, especially when thinking about the relationship between individuals and their community. I'm just wondering, I know you must have thought about this, other than dollars, especially when we're thinking about well being, because that's what we're going to do for the world, and certainly I think we're going to do GDP. So help us out a little bit, if you could, and that's to everyone who's on the panel because you touched it.
Let me start. So most of the countries in the world use a system that measures DALYs, disability-adjusted life years, and QALYs, quality-adjusted life years. We don't do that in the U.S., but probably should be doing it. So you could look at QALYs. So basically, when you prevent a suicide, how many QALYs do you gain for that person and that community? And, you know, how do you attribute the qualities to the program the same way you attribute dollars? So I think work could be done to do that kind of work here. That would be very good. I have the floor, one other measurement system here. So there is a very good measurement system that NIH has developed called the PROMIS system. Patient-reported outcome measurement information system. And I have the link in my PowerPoint. I didn't go over that. You might want to look at that because there's some very good and validated measures in there that look at your personal well-being, your social well-being, your emotional well-being, and so on, that are validated and are used by NIH. We're trying to get them used more broadly because they invested a huge amount of money in developing and validating these measures. So a little bit different way of looking at it here.
Wayne, were you going to answer?
No.
Yes.
I have a question about you mentioned strategies around prevention and early intervention, but the things that you mentioned were mostly like referral-type programs, recognizing and referring people to care, the things like that. Do you have other examples of programs that might be sort of more around community and individual resiliency or well-being?
The Each Mind Matters, Note Signs, those are general community business, and the Each Mind Matters especially is creating conversations about, it's not to necessarily get somebody to treatment. We're always aware that is important and that should be linked to what we're doing, that if there is some acknowledgement, some recognition that somebody needs treatment, then you want to get them to treatment. But to get the conversation moving in the conversation, the Each Mind Matters campaign, that people can talk about and think about mental health and mental well-being in the community.
The concepts that I think this panel really made me think of is this notion of making the acceptable unacceptable. There was a paper published 7 years ago about this, and what a lot of this work is trying to do is to say it is unacceptable to have this kind of burden of mental illness, and how can we change culture around it? And it's actually an extraordinarily powerful concept, and it's also extraordinarily difficult. There's another hand up. Yes, in the back. Can you just tell me where to stop?
Right
here? Is there a question or a photo op? It's a slide selfie. This is how you know you've arrived, when somebody takes a picture of your slide. Yes, go ahead, question in the front.
I actually have a question on that slide. Ah.
This doesn't just look good, it's also has substance. Yes.
Is the return
on investment
just a
one-time
$1,100,
or you know, you talk about the 28 years of somebody's working life, is that just once, or does it keep on going every year, or?
So we've set this up to reflect the amount spent each year, and the effect of the spending just from that year. So the spending was done over 3 years, so this is annual, so that Mesa spent $356,000 per year on assists and trained about 79 assist trainers in that year, and this is what we estimate to be the cumulative effect of those 79. They're active for up to 14 years, and they train on average 150. So, and then those 150 are active for about 10 years. So yeah, it extends this particular effect, which 11 of 7 is going to be realized over 24 years.
So,
So there's another, you can do another denominator or another calculation that the 1100 is divided by 24 years. Is that what I just understood you said?
Well, that's the return over, that's a cumulative return over 24 years. So this investment will continue to have an effect over 24 years. And you can sum up that as a value, it converts to 100.
Over those 24 years, is the 153 lives saved? What is that a percentage of all of the suicides in there? And then did you compare with other suicide prevention strategies? You have a comparison analysis of dollars spent to quality produced.
Good question. So if you take the average suicide rate in California over the past 3 years, and project that forward, assuming it stays constant for 10 years, the 153 represents about 0.4% reduction in suicide attempts. So it's not big by itself, it's not a huge change in suicide deaths. Your other question about how does it compare? We didn't do comparative studies.
Like comparing car studies with San Francisco, right?
Well, there were some other studies that were done, UCLA had done a few, Washington had a few. Their method was a little bit different than ours. And so we haven't really, we would have to be able to compare sort of apples to apples in a way, and we couldn't.
Back to the question about ACEs that you were talking about. Wondering about maternal child depression. We have initiatives in Colorado where about files in land, and you focused on comprehensively. We have a number of things for the early childhood population and ACEs. So, what about these sort of tools or education or screening?
So I only know of one study that was ever done on children of mentally ill parents. And we published that in Mental Health US probably, I want to say 2002 or something like that. So there's very little work done on that subject. However, I think if you go back and look at that, it'll be useful to you. And I would argue that some of the same tools I'm talking about here. So the depression screen we got into the implementation of the Affordable Care Act would be useful for the mother. And it would be particularly useful to look at this issue postpartum, because probably 20 to 30% of mothers have postpartum depression. And then you could look at that population relative to mothers who do not have postpartum depression and so on. So, but that particular area is very poorly studied. I had a tough time finding even a single study to put in Mental Health US.
I'll make one comment on that. We already discussed that we're not including family benefits in the analysis, but one of the papers that we did looked at mothers who had mental illness and the likelihood their kids will develop mental illness if they were traumatized. And there's a very clear intergenerational effect that if a mom has a mental illness, if the child is traumatized, she is much more likely to have mental illness. So these are ultimately, somebody mentioned the water. I like that metaphor very much. It is changing the water by reducing these kind of traumas, by reducing, for example, the trauma of suicide that a family is experiencing. And the value of that is large and extends over generations. Last two questions. There and here. Yes, go ahead.
Star D
is the star.
And it was a treatment star study D. Of mothers. And it was the only study that I'm aware of that shows direct benefits to their children when mothers' symptoms remitted. So it's a really good argument for early intervention for parents in terms of improving family well-being.
If people are interested in this, slightly shameless bit of self-promotion. We did a book called Life Course Approach to Mental Disorders, came out last year from Oxford, actually they have here, which really synthesized literature on how mental disorders accumulate over the life course with intergenerational transmission. Sir, you have the last question.
Just one more question about the exhibition, wondering what you learned from it in these two different ways. One, despite the tremendous ROI, as you say, the impact on suicide in California was very, very small. So I'm wondering if you learned, one, things about the program such that you could increase its power and effectiveness through the gatekeepers that were trained, because presumably some of the people who did suicide passed through their aid. And second, whether it inspired other kinds of programs, perhaps similarly structured, that would go after different pathways of suicide.
It clearly indicated to us that we wanted to expand further these kind of trainings, and the idea of training one person to train others, that you really get much more bang for your buck that way. But using evidence-based practices like that, we would then try to expand. It requires resources and willingness, but I think we've got that in California, and we'll continue to try to do that.
Lisa, join me in thanking this panel for really interesting work.